I'm Afshin Ratansian. Welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE on the anniversary of the Nanjing Massacre, when Anglo-French-American Empire catalyzed up to 200,000 killed in China by Imperial Japan. This month also marks the 36th anniversary of the US toppling of CIA asset and drug lord Noriega of Panama. It's a reminder of US interference south of the Rio Grande. Tens of millions have been killed, wounded, or displaced as the US-backed death squad since 1945. Destabilized Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Honduras, Panama, Cuba, Brazil, Chile, Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay, Bolivia, Colombia, Peru, Mexico, and of course, Venezuela. Trump and his war secretary, Pete Hegseth, along with his neocon Secretary of State Rubio, have been involved in extrajudicial murder of fishermen in Venezuelan waters in the past few days as part of another war on Venezuela. This time, it's not so much fake human rights concerns from CIA cutout NGOs. Trump is using drugs as a pretext to try and persuade Americans to support regime change headed by Machado, this year's Gaza genocide-supporting Nobel Peace Prize winner. Everyone, except stenographers masquerading as journalists, knows that this is about American imperialism and the largest known supply of oil in the world. Backing Venezuela is Russia, China, and Iran, and the entire global South that is not run by Washington puppets. In Caracas is Venezuela's former Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs for North America. Carlos Ron is now co-coordinator of the Tricontinental Institute's Nuestra America office. Carlos, thank you so much for coming back on. I better just start off by asking you about the mood in Venezuela and whether Trump has united the Venezuelan people behind Maduro as he's extrajudicially killed fishermen in Venezuelan waters.
Well, first of all, thank you for the invitation. And yes, I think that one of the effects precisely of these hostilities that we have seen increase in the last several weeks, I think has been a sense of national unity. Because on even some sectors of the Venezuelan opposition that before, of course, have opposed President Maduro, don't see themselves as socialists, etc., they are also questioning this idea of the possibility of an intervention against Venezuela from a foreign power. I think there's not a sense of panic. This I think is important to say. I mean, the population of Venezuela is carrying on their everyday lives, but everybody is cautious because everybody understands the history of the United States intervention in Latin America. Everybody knows of the possibility of, you know, an intervention, a coup, you know, all these things that have gone on in the past. But there's a sense of rejection to this. There's a sense that if we have problems within Venezuela, it is up to Venezuela to solve them, not for a foreign power to intervene.
I mean, obviously, China is usually more reserved in these matters. Going Underground was recently in India, where President Putin was signing deals with Prime Minister Modi over military equipment. And just as I was introducing some of them, there were reports the Russian Navy had arrived in the region. Do you think that would help if President Putin, I'm not sure whether you know whether the Russian Navy has arrived or not, but would that help?
Well, I think this is an issue that should not, we should not expect foreign countries to intervene. I think Venezuela has always counted on itself for its defense. I think that that's the safest thing that we can do is rely on ourselves. And we do have friends throughout the world. And I think the role they're playing, denouncing U.S. interventionism, denouncing all these hostilities of the illegal attacks on in the Caribbean, I think that's very important. But I think that Venezuela's ready to rely on themselves and not on anybody else.
Except that, of course, I know you say there's no sense of panic. We know that Trump has already, through the use of sanctions, killed untold numbers of people. I mean, Trump won then Genocide Joe, a CEPR report from 2019 saying how many, 40,000? Tens of thousands have been killed there by the sanctions.
Yes. Well, I mean, this is a new type of war. I mean, and this is something that we must understand. Conventional war is over. I think the idea is now that when you want to destroy a government, when you want to destroy a people, you now have a sort of hybrid type of approach. And what they have used against Venezuela has been diplomatic channels, has been the economic sanctions, as they're miscalled, but, you know, the pressures on the economic financial systems against Venezuela. They've used the media war, of course. I mean, the narratives that you hear throughout the mainstream media everywhere is that, you know, Venezuela is a dangerous place because there are criminal gangs and drug lords and all this. But it's not true. But it's a way of adding up all these weapons they have to attack the Venezuelan nation as a whole and to remove President Maduro from office or provoke an attempt at removing him from office so that they can impose someone there that is more friendly to U.S. Foreign policy and U.S. objectives. And of course, they can provide oil to meet their requirements.
Yeah, wall-to-wall coverage in NATO Nation television of the Nobel Peace Prize winner, Machado, I think a relative of hers. I think she took a boat to Curaçao and failed to arrive in Oslo. I don't know whether going in a boat was wise for her. But as you say, the media, bizarre media, some of it in the United States, pricier avocados, blame narco inflation. And of course, the context of all the drug talk being that Trump, a free leader who let cocaine flow to U.S., Juan Orlando Hernandez, the ex-president of Honduras, which Honduras has now indicted. Is it the equivalent of Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, the drugs?
Yes, I think it's equivalent in the sense that is a lie that is molded throughout the different spokespersons and different data that they look for to try to defend this this aggression, this hostility. But you know, every report, even the DEA's own assessment on drug trafficking shows that 87% of drug trafficking going to the United States goes through the Pacific Ocean, and Venezuela doesn't have a coast in the Pacific Ocean. I mean, this the thing that Venezuela it could be the real source of the problems that the U.S. has with the war on drugs or the whole issue of drug trafficking is absurd. I mean, they have spent the last 50 years in this so-called war on drugs, spent over $1 trillion trying to curtail it, and the result is that there's a more drug consumption and drug distribution within the United States. So it's what it has been used for, though, is for displacement of local populations, not only in Venezuela. I mean, we have seen this happen in Colombia and other places in South America. I mean, they have used the pretext of the war on drugs to intervene inside these countries to, you know, displace populations from important resources and land. And always from an ulterior motive, not the real motive of trying to attack drugs.
Except, of course, it's not the days of the pink tide. The Chilean election, one of them, is held on Sunday. No candidates are there for Venezuela. I mean, look at Lula, who has been on this program, President Lula of Brazil. He came on this program after he was released from prison. Do you blame Lula for not supporting Venezuela's entry into BRICS? He reportedly vetoed it at the Kazan summit.
Well, I think it was definitely I would say a bad decision that Venezuela did not enter BRICS. I think Venezuela has a lot to offer.
Well, it was Lula's fault, wasn't it? Lula's fault.
Well, I think, I mean, whoever made the decision on the Brazilian side or you know, with how throughout the BRICS process is truly made poor judgment and poor foresight, because what Venezuela could provide to BRICS is important. But I think we can definitely go beyond that in the sense that Venezuela has ties to the BRIC countries. And I think Venezuela can be involved in all sort of arrangements with BRIC countries. And eventually, I think that's something that we can achieve in a future opening.
Yeah, it's something that...
I don't think that's necessarily... I don't think that's necessarily a problem. I think what is important, though, going back to the region, where you said about the pink tide, I think what's important is to recognize that there's this angry tide throughout the region, that is the result of years of conservative movements trying to get hold of power in Latin America. And there's a need for the left to look into how it can work together to, you know, put a hold on this conservative wave that is going to take Latin America into a deeper inequality that it has already been for the last several years.
Yeah, and it's been largely successful, don't you think? I mean, we've had Rafael Correa on this show. He's wanted, of course, in Ecuador. We now have a reputed drug dealer in Noboa running Ecuador.
Yes, but I think we have to see that how long can this be sustained? Because I mean, what is sustaining these right wing governments? It's repression, it's money and support from the U.S. In the long run, they're not going to be able to sustain it.
Well, I think we should probably remind our audience about some of the amazing, dazzling statistics of the Bolivarian Revolution. Life expectancy in Venezuela under sanctions. I mentioned that tens of thousands have been killed by them, is in the low 70s. In some U.S. counties, it's in the 50s. Literacy in Venezuela now 98%. These are the latest figures, official figures. In some U.S. counties, it's 50%. But the thing is, doesn't that show that the United States spending 7 times more on military per capita is actually the decisive policy decision here? It can be successful in a takeover of Venezuela, in a war on Venezuela. You don't have any friends in the region who will come out militarily to support you, and Venezuela should have been spending much more on weaponry than on making their people literate and on healthcare.
Well, no, I think the strength of Venezuela is precisely having been able to take care of our people. I mean, the fact that the Venezuelan government still stands throughout all these years of the tide is because there was a true commitment to social policy, a true commitment to eradicate illiteracy, a true commitment for social programs to have access to education, to have access to medicine, even in times of economic sanctions. And now, you know, it's because of that that became a priority that you have people willing to defend the country in the case of an aggression. You had over 8 million people go to the streets and sign up for a militia. And I don't think that's a small number. I don't think that's a small figure. I think that's a reflection of people not wanting their country to be attacked and to be pushed around. Now, and I think that, you know, precisely is having a commitment to a policy that's not neoliberal exploitation is what has allowed Venezuela to survive to weather all these hybrid war attacks against it the last 4 years.
Carlos Ron, I'll stop you there. More from the former Venezuelan Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs for North America after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with Venezuela's former Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs for North America, Carlos Ron. Carlos, at the end of part one, you were talking about Venezuela's achievements in the face of the wrath of NATO nations. The Bank of England, of course, stole billions of dollars worth of your gold. But nevertheless, Trump very keen to talk about how friends that he meets or Venezuelans that he meets, expats, talk to him about the evils of the Bolivarian Revolution. I mean, many have left Venezuela because of the sanctions. Ironically, do you think Trump will help them return by, or at least stem the flow by his treatment of Venezuelans in the United States?
Well, to me, it doesn't make sense the way this policy is being carried out, because when Trump speaks about migration being his greatest concern, about migrants being, you know, a problem to the United States, and then when he applied the very vicious attack on the Venezuelan nationals, because remember, you know, he brought back the law against Alien Enemies Act to criminalize Venezuelan migrants, basically, accusing them of being part of a gang. And even though there was no proof, no trial, no process to reveal that, then he even sent some of them to El Salvador in a concentration camp, to take them out of the country. Well, you know, you're doing all this move to get rid of Venezuelans. If you start a war in the region of the Caribbean, what do you expect is going to happen? I mean, you're going to have a massive displacement of people that is a result in all wars. I mean, you don't have to be an expert to know that. Any conflict that you have seen throughout the world in the last several years, you see that there's massive displacement, and that precisely migrants are going to try to come up to the United States for a safe haven. So it doesn't make sense that on one side you're trying to get rid of the migrants, and then you're trying to exacerbate conditions that would actually promote more migration.
I'll give you a reason, though, that migration isn't as important as another issue, which is the privatization of your oil industry and the need by the United States to exploit Venezuela's resources. Isn't it clear that Venezuela will always be in danger from the North by by a dying empire, especially? And shouldn't Venezuela have taken action to protect itself? Nuclear weapons, perhaps, as the deterrent? Because without that, the United States can, of course, win a war, a destructive war, against Venezuela, no matter how many millions join the brigades and how much support for Maduro there is.
Look, Venezuela is a country that even constitutionally has barred nuclear weapons. I think, you know, that has not been a question, you know, in the public. I think that you're right. I think that, you know, as long as we have oil wealth and other mineral wealth, Venezuela is always going to be a target of the United States, or large multinational corporations, etc. But I also think that whoever thinks that Venezuela is an easy target because they have I understand the United States has, of course, a military superiority. I'm not naive in that sense. But to think that Venezuela is an easy target, that Venezuela is some place that you can come in and just take over, you're up for a surprise. I think there's a long history here of resistance, of morale to resist attacks. I think we have seen also the tragic sort of interventions that the United States has done in recent years. I mean, you could go back to Vietnam and remember how tragic that was. But even Afghanistan, Iraq, all these more recent interventions have shown that, you know, if you don't have the support of a local population, if there isn't some sort of other arrangement, you're not going to be successful. I mean, after 20 years of a disaster, they caused in Afghanistan, they had to leave without accomplishing anything. That's horrible for our people, you know, in the sense that, of course, if something to that comes to happen, and I really wish that it doesn't come to happen, it's going to be hurtful for the Venezuelan people. But I think they have to think twice about what really is at stake and how this is going to affect the stability of the United States. We're not, you know, hundreds or thousands of miles away. We're really close to the United States, and it could have a terrible effect for its economy, for its own base. I mean, if you look at the base that supports President Trump right now, a lot of the criticism that is coming is precisely from his own base, who were promised that there would be no more forever wars, there would be no more endless
But you're ascribing some kind of rationality as regards this dying empire. And isn't that the problem? As you say, I mean, even if Venezuela wins like Afghanistan defeated the United States, the toll on the Venezuelan people will be catastrophic. I don't know what Hugo Chavez would have done differently to Maduro. I should say I met Hugo Chavez in better times and in worse times. And I lived in Venezuela for a while in Margarita Island. Do you believe that Maduro is giving far too much leeway to this rationality on the part of Washington? And Marco Rubio, Rubio, as he's called.
Sure. And I have to say something. You know, I believe that, first of all, the comparison is always difficult because, you know, under President Chavez, we didn't have the severity of the attacks that we have faced, that we currently face. I mean, for sure, there was always antagonism, but the level of sanctions and, you know, all the other, even this military hostility was not present. And I think if there's something that we have, that President Maduro has shown, it has been his capability at negotiation, at dialogue, his willingness to dialogue, even under, this hostility. He has been willing to sit down and find ways to avoid war. And I think everything that he has done to protect Venezuela, I mean, and his leadership, the leadership of his political party, you know, to try to strengthen the Venezuelan morale, to try to strengthen the Venezuelan economy, to try to maintain social programs running even in the face of adversity, is important to have a, you know, a consolidated country. I have a lot of faith in his capability of you know, trying until the very end to avoid a confrontation without losing, you know, Venezuelan sovereignty.
Of course, the worst crime of this century, one of the worst crimes perhaps ever, has been the Gaza genocide in this region from where I'm speaking to you. What is it with these Nobel Peace Prize winner Machado and the so-called opposition in Venezuela? What is their obsession with supporting the Gaza genocide in the region I'm speaking to you from? And their claims, and there have been bizarre claims, that Margarita Island was a center for Lebanese resistance. The former Assistant Secretary of State Roger Noriega, in a relation in 2011, saying Margarita Island is a center for Lebanese resistance operations in the Americas. That's testimony to Congress in 2013. There are terror training bases on Margarita Island. What are they talking about? And why is Israel so associated with the forces against Maduro and the Bolivarian Revolution?
Well, I think that, you know, the most important thing is that President Chavez, at his time, he took an important stand, and perhaps, you know, something that was that hadn't been done before, and that forcefully in the history of Latin America, was to break relations with Israel, precisely because of his attacks on Gaza back then, you know, in I believe 2008, if I'm not mistaken, you know, so I think that since the policy of Israel or international Zionism has been precisely to punish Venezuela for taking that stand, and you know that, you know, there's they have ways of paying for certain media outlets, paying for certain think tanks to develop stories, and they develop this fantastic narratives where they, you know, they mix people up and they say, oh, these different movements and organizations are terrorists, and then they place them here in Venezuela. I mean, Venezuela has a history of receiving immigrants since a very long time, and it is true that, you know, historically Venezuela has had a lot of Lebanese, Syrian, Palestinian migrants. But to say that people from these communities, you know, are hiding or I don't know, terrorists in the making, is part of the narrative that they wanted to use to punish Venezuela for taking a stand in defense of the people of Palestine. I think, you know, and of course, Since the government of President Chavez and President Maduro has continued that stand, that is precisely why the extremist opposition of Venezuela takes the Israel path, because they want to obtain resources, they want to obtain support from Israel to defeat the Venezuelan revolution in a way that they can't do by votes, by winning, you know, with their own political project. And this is what they've tried to do all along. And Maria Corina Machado signed an agreement, her political movement signed an agreement with Likud in Israel. She has promised that if she becomes president of Venezuela, she would move the embassy to Jerusalem, or open an embassy of Venezuela in Israel, in Jerusalem, etc. This is, you know, it's part of this political alliance of people that want to punish the Venezuelan government for standing for the Palestinian people.
Yeah. Corina Machado said the struggle of Venezuela is the struggle of Israel, writing to Netanyahu, along with the puppet Milei of Argentina. I suppose, just finally, given the wall-to-wall propaganda, and I know that Venezuela tried Telesur to try and break into against the propaganda of NATO nation propaganda media. Just to explain finally, who is this Nobel Peace Prize winner of 2025, and does she fit into the mold of other Peace Prize winners like the butcher of Libya, Obama, and the famous Henry Kissinger?
Well, right now, yes, I think right now we have to question the standards of the Nobel Peace Prize, because before we used to understand someone receiving the award as somebody that was fighting for a noble cause, for an ideal, that faced hardships. Now is, you know, a collection of people that are involved in massacres, are involved in exploitation, and of course, in genocide. Maria Corina Machado is a representative of the Venezuelan elite. She has been so for throughout her political life, and she has strived against the democratic process that was being carried out here in Venezuela. Her family is one of the wealthiest families that helped maintain a system of exclusion to the masses here in Venezuela. So now she pretends to be this sort of freedom fighter or democracy fighter, but she has been probably one of the most hardline people in the Venezuelan opposition.
Is she a terrorist?
Refusing to dialogue with the government. Oh, I think she has promoted actions of terrorism, because she has called. She was one of the promoters of what we call the Guarimbas, which were violent protests both in 2014 and 2017. And you know that the result of these protests were around 40 people dead. You know, people that were burned alive because of the skin color, because they said, "Oh, this person is a Afro-descendant, he must be a Chavista, you must go out and kill them." I mean, these are acts of terror, of course. So I there's no way that a person like this, that a person that calls on a different country like the United States to invade Venezuela, she wrote to the Security Council when Argentina and Israel were members of the Security Council. She wrote asking for an intervention on Venezuela. With a military intervention from the Security Council. I mean, nobody that, I don't understand, at least I don't understand how you could be for peace and ask for, foreign governments to invade your own country militarily. That to me doesn't make sense. So I guess that yes, if Kissinger is there, if Obama's there, then I guess I'm the one not understanding what the word peace means in the peace prize.
Carlos Ron, thank you.
Thank you.
And that's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those bereaved by the UK-US-EU armed genocide across Palestine, Lebanon and Syria. We'll be back on Monday with a former CIA officer who went to prison for blowing the whistle on the agency's torture program. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Monday.